From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who built them. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
You know, we had some really big customer contracts, and I very much enjoyed doing that. So, I mean, we did a deal with Heineken that was 2 billion bottles a year, and it was a 10-year contract, so 10 times that, and that was a fixed contract.
I'm Conor Carney, and that's the voice of Niall Wall, Executive Chairman of Enva, a leading provider of waste management and recycling solutions operating across 30 facilities in the UK and Ireland, employing over 1,500 people. Between 2006 and 2016, Niall was the CEO of the Ardagh Group, an Irish packaging PLC listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Over that 10-year period as CEO, Niall and the team grew the business from 650 million to 8 billion in annual revenues. In this conversation, Niall talks about investing in large public companies, what the key strategies were when growing Ardagh, and the learnings he gained running his very first startup, a quail farm, in his early 20s. I started out by asking Niall to talk me through the business of the Ardagh Group.
Ardagh is a public company quoted in New York. It's a packaging specialist that focuses on the manufacture of glass products for container packaging and also metal can production. It's one of the largest companies in its space in the world, and it started off as a single glass plant in Dublin in 1934. Essentially, it stayed as such until roughly the late 90s, when Ardagh then bought a company called Rockware in the UK, which was five times its size as a reverse takeover. And then from there, had a number of years before it sort of expanded again. And then in 2011, it went from being purely a glass manufacturer into the metal can business with an acquisition of a company called Impress in 2011, which was quite large. So when I started, it turnover of about 650 million euro, and it had an EBITDA of roughly 50 million. And then during the sort of 10-year period where I had been CEO, working closely with Paul Coulson, who's the chairman and the board, and of course the 5,000 people who are already working there, we managed to build it to, I think, when I retired, it had 8 billion turnover, and we had an EBITDA of, the run rate was about 1.3 billion at that stage. And that was prior to going public. In fact, the company went public shortly after after I retired, which was a good point for me to leave. Now it has it's got about 18, 19 countries and about, I'd say, 100 plants spread throughout the world.
It seems like quite a large jump. Over what time period did it go from 50 million in EBITDA to, you know, over a billion?
10-year period.
10-year period.
Yeah. So essentially what happened is we did one acquisition in 2007, which doubled our size from 650 million to 1.3 million. That was in the glass sector. And then we bought a business in the US, another $800 million, roughly. So we were up around the sort of 1.8 million. And then we did the transaction into can making, which we acquired a business which had a turnover of about 1.7 billion, 300 million EBITDA. So, you know, there were big, chunky steps along the way. But basically, the real model in terms of the profitability, and that sounds great from the M&A, but it was really the extraction of synergies and the operational excellence, which really drove the margins and, in fact, allowed for the business to be able to continuously growth and making these large acquisition steps. And so obviously we were funded mostly through the capital markets, and that allowed us to go back to those markets because we were building up a very good proven track record of being able to extract and build and essentially do what we said we'd do.
How difficult is that to get synergies out of a M&A transaction? Because I do hear that, you know, it sounds like a great thing. Oh, we'll take over a business and we'll improve the kind of cost structure. We'll put our system into that business. But it sometimes doesn't work out like that. Is it a difficult thing to achieve that with the takeover?
It is, because often what happens, and certainly my experience, is that Often the synergies that you may get may not be the ones that you thought you were going to get at the start. So, you know, with the best will in the world, you can take a McKinsey forensic approach to how you might extract those synergies, or you may stick and group into larger buckets and then apply a huge amount of focus on analysis after the transaction is done to make sure that you're able to get it. But my experience is that we pretty much almost always got this headline number, which we thought we would get out of a deal, but they may not have always come exactly according to how we may have seen it prior to completing it. So I'd love to tell you that it all worked like clockwork. We listed out every synergy and then we just one by one extracted them all, but business isn't a perfect science. So it didn't quite operate in that fashion.
How much work goes into one of these takeovers at the start? How well do you need to know the business? And what kind of things are you looking for at that time when looking to take over even a much larger business than the business you're currently operating?
It depends. If you're operating in a business that's the same space and you're just applying a different geography to it, you know, the manufacturing processes should relatively be similar. You know, the customer base should be similar. And, you know, so you might be into differences of that management style or cultural issues or even geographical cultural issues. You know, I mean, operating in France, for instance, is entirely different to operating in the US. So they're two pretty polar opposites in terms of, you know, how one might operate and manage a business. As the French would say, quels prix, they don't always mix terribly well, those cultures, even in a business sense. So, you know, then you can have problems. But generally speaking, you're able to analyze and get a decent amount of due diligence beforehand. And so it would be silly to go into a deal not having a fairly good picture. But you never can have really enough information. And then sometimes you can get too much information, which is essentially that you've got tons of data, but not actually that great amount of you can't get necessarily a good holistic picture of what's actually going on. So that's something one needs to be careful of as well. And in my experience, sometimes actually what happens is you get caught in the weeds of a deal and then the sort of the bigger picture gets missed a little bit. So it's a nuance that needs to be carefully managed, but it certainly helps if you're acquiring a business that's in your own space. And, you know, one would hope that you then have got the ability to be able to assess that business with some degree of a knowledge base. When I started Nardab, I arrived in as the CEO designate and I had no experience of the glass industry at all. I had no experience of the packaging industry. I had not really that much of a clue how to make glass. In fact, I had no clue whatsoever. Suddenly, here I was, designate CEO of a business with 3,500 people and an operation factory in Poland, 2 in Germany, 5 in the UK. And I would be going around sitting, looking at the management meeting, and the guys would say, I'm here for 40 years. And then somebody else would say, oh, I'm in the business for 30 years. Oh, I'm the new guy. I'm only here a decade. And then it would come to me and I would say, well, this is my third day. And I'm your new boss.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting personal challenge for me. Yeah.
Niall, how did that come to be initially? How did you join the business?
How I joined the business quite simply was that for essentially 15 years, I basically worked with Paul Coulson, and that was, we started in Tipperary Crystal, which was a business that they owned that needed some attention. In fact, it was a business that they acquired out of insolvency. Essentially, we then put a lot of work into turning it around. We approached Tony Ryan. Tony then bought 40% of it, and Tony and Declan, so they came onto the board. So at that stage, we had a small company and a very heavyweight board. Paul on the board, Tony was chairman, and Declan was on the board. And so I was getting plenty of help and advice, as you can imagine. And then from that business, essentially the Ryans bought that, and then Yeoman had already got this medical waste management business that was hemorrhaging a huge amount of, looked like as if it was probably going to go bust. They approached me and asked me, would I get involved in it, which I did. And then we turned that around and ended up having a very good success with it. I had been working with some private equity companies who were in the bid process to buy that business. And I was about to do a deal and Paul phoned me and said, look, would you come and have a chat? Eddie Kilty, who is the CEO of Arda, wishes to retire and maybe you'd like to take over. So that was a hell of a surprise, but it was also a phenomenal opportunity. So I said yes. There was a couple of conditions, but to be fair, that was fine on both sides. One of them was that I was able to buy 10% of Arda at the time. So that was a hugely important move for me personally, but I did it. And then we went along that incredible journey, which was essentially a 10-year period, not only good from a business standpoint, enormously challenging, but also great fun. Most of it was actually good fun as well, which is a very important aspect, I think, that people miss out on sometimes in both their career and indeed, you know, the focus in which they have on trying to achieve something. I don't think if one enjoys it, I think maybe they're not necessarily doing the right thing. Mostly enjoy it. No one enjoys it all because everyone has got the bad days, and the bad days can be pretty bad. But generally, I think it's important to enjoy what you're doing.
And what was it that you mainly enjoyed about working in Arda? Was it the people, the business? What was it that really stood out to you?
Well, first of all, it was a challenge because trying to get to grips with a business that I knew nothing about and to do that in a way that I wasn't coming up with all the answers for the simple reason I couldn't come up with all the answers because I simply didn't have the experience or the knowledge, certainly technically or manufacturing or operating or from an operational standpoint or the science of glass making. So, you know, the reality of it is one needs to then pick a really good team and not to be afraid to ask the silly questions. So at the start, instead of sort of pretending I knew it all, I was quite absolutely straight and said, look, I'm actually the opposite to knowing it all. But I think I probably have, hopefully I've got a decent amount or some amount of business acumen and hopefully we'll be able to move this along. At that time, Arda was reasonably challenged as well because the 50 million EBITDA sounds good. It's 50 million on 650 million. You know, it's a low percentage EBITDA for manufacturing and for glass manufacturing. The capital expenditure was probably about 7 or 8%. So it meant it was a very, very challenged time. And really what helped us get out of it was when we did this first acquisition, which was doubling of the size, which essentially brought a much bigger European footprint to the business, as opposed to being uniquely sort of UK and Ireland. So, you know, we had some really big customer contracts and I very much enjoyed doing that. So, I mean, we did a deal with Heineken that was 2 billion bottles a year. And it was a 10-year contract, so 10 times that. And that was a fixed contract. It was a take-or-pay contract. And half of that was essentially a dedicated factory, which we had only making Heineken bottles. And, you know, the whole negotiation of that deal and bringing it to its fruition, that was a really valuable thing to our business because, obviously, with a 10-year contract with Heineken, for that amount of bottles, we were able to, you know, present ourselves to capital markets and say that, look, you know, this is the kind of business that will really is very financeable. So when I started, you know, we had 7 or 8 plant managers and I knew every single one of them and I would have known my way around, you know, where to go to the office or where the loo was or, you know, and certainly where to get a coffee. But by the time I left, we had 121 plants, some I had never even visited. So how one operates and manages cannot be the same at that stage as it was at the beginning. So I enjoyed really that journey, that entrepreneurial journey, I think more than sort of the latter end where, it, you know, it was becoming more like a regular public company that's quite institutionalized. And, you know, there was no way we were going to build a business at 8 million, 70 times its size again. You know, so I think it's actually from then to now, Arda has divested one part of its business. It's actually shrunk in size a little bit, although hugely successful. But it's more or less the same sort of size as when I had left it.
So when you were joining the business, I mean, you didn't understand, or I suppose you didn't know the glass business very well. You didn't know how glass was made and everything. Was there anything you could put your finger on that you kind of said, I can do that? You know, maybe it was the strategy towards takeovers or something, maybe on the finance side. Was there anything that you kind of had a confidence in yourself that you could do and you could do a good job in that role?
The first thing was to simplify everything. So, you know, instead of then getting hugely complicated answers or something, you know, it was to basically simplify and understand what actually does the business do, how does it do it, who are the competitors, what are the industry dynamics. So, for instance, in a business like that, a key element is the equilibrium between supply and demand. Very, very simple. It's not a commodity, but it's a commoditized industry. So, you know, if there's too much capacity, customers who are very sophisticated, such as the Heinekens, such as Heinz, you know, such as Diageo, Unilever, Procter & Gamble, they will use that very much to their benefit through their very sophisticated supply chain operations. And they will procure much better deals for them. And that normally is at the expense then of the supplier. So understanding the industry and understanding what fitted where and what your strengths and weaknesses were hugely important. So in our dad, that start period, we were the number one in Northern Europe. We had very little in Southern Europe, where we were number three overall in Europe. So one of the things I learned very, very early was that if you were about to lose volume to a competitor, we would say to the customer, that's fine. We understand what you're doing. You think you've got a better price. But the minute you move, we're going to cut that production. So if it doesn't work out with your new supplier, so we're just telling you now, you can't come back to us because there's no capacity. So we're just telling you that's the simple situation. And what price we had given you for the volume we'd given you, that was for that amount, that was for that volume. So the price for the lower volume is a higher. So what we would do is simply erode the benefit of the switch to, and therefore try to get it to a point whereby it wasn't worth their while. The risk of moving wasn't actually worth. So they would start off, oh, I've got a 20% cheaper price. That's great. Fantastic. Well done, you. That's, you know, and then we'd get down into the nitty gritties, and then we'd bring it down to, you know, item by item, SKU by SKU. And then we would know that there were things that the others couldn't produce. And so we would just put a whacking huge price increase on those. And then when they totted it all up, that's how we defend it. And that's, when you ask me about the learning, that's as important about, you know, glass is chemistry of sand, silica sand, and, you know, five different things. Like, there are tons of people who know and do that, and I would never be able to know by tweaking the mix that we might be able to get a better glass, for instance. I was never going to get to that level. So it was really then having a holistic generalist approach, which was never nothing more than I was ever going to be able to bring to it. And then also the working with very, very smart and good people. So I tried to get people who were smarter than me to join, and that was very helpful.
What did a day look like for you as CEO of such a large company? I'm assuming you're not doing a lot of technical work. I suppose people are presenting reports for you to review and everything else. Where was your mind for these years?
It was really focusing on the areas that probably needed most attention. So if a part of the business was going well, then, you know, that was fine. The other important point is that when you're running a business of that size, the teams are very well established. And in most instances, you try to strive to have good teams. Now, funny enough, where you had a weaker team, you know, the business perhaps wasn't doing so well, then the KPIs wouldn't be good, then the health and safety wouldn't be good, then the production numbers wouldn't be good, then the average selling price wouldn't be good, then the stocks would be too high. You know, it's a common thread throughout that. And so obviously we would have very formal monthly reviews of each of the businesses. And so we would have Glass, America, Glass, Europe. We'd have the metal business, Europe, the metal business, Australia, Europe. And, you know, we would then focus it, and then we would go down to various different countries. And then we would find, you know, we would just basically through KPI management, we would then really focus on the areas that needed more attention and essentially the gaps to our budget or where we needed to, you know, basically what every business essentially does. And we would then focus our attention on how to solve whatever problems we had. You know, we'd have a whole capital expenditure program, which would then have to be assessed, etc. And then there were always five times more demand for that budget than there were resources available.
How many people would have been working on the capital expenditure budget and in terms of the capital allocation and where to spend it? I mean, how much work went into that process?
It was done business by business. So it was a bottoms-up approach. Then the actual sort of countries or the businesses or the functions would then essentially go through a whole set of assessment. So by the time I would see it, it would be pretty well baked. And then, you know, we would then go through it, and we would rigidly look at basically the quickest returns, the most profitable, or if something was strategic to support a customer who was terribly important to us. And we might have had a customer contract renewing, So there are lots of different aspects to it. So in the glass business, because it was quite technical to make the plants, we had an actual technical services, a whole group of people, which was multinational. That sounds great, but there were might have been 100 people in it.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. What was your very first business?
A commercial quail farm, which is started off really more for the emotional thing than anything, because I started it with a girlfriend whose family happened to be in the business. So that's how a fellow from Dublin ends up in the country on a farm. But it was a business which we started, and I was lucky enough to be able to buy my first house without a mortgage out of it. So it was reasonably successful.
Is the quail business still a good business?
I don't think it's even going anymore. Not in Ireland, the market is a bit small. I left in 1994 or something, so...
And who were the customers of that business? I'm kind of fascinated with that particular business, because I suppose it's where you would have learned some of the fundamentals of what you took on into later.
No, definitely. I mean, because we started something from scratch, and you know, it's the buzzword is, as you know, amongst all of your peers, is, you know, it's all startup. Everyone, that's the buzz that everyone's mm-hmm. Oh, what are you gonna do? Oh, I'm gonna do a startup. Well, when we were doing it, it was a startup. It wasn't a startup in the conventional sense of today, where everybody wants to do a tech startup so it was a bit of an old school startup, but it had input costs, it had a process, it needed customers, it had regulation, because our processing plant had to be approved by it had to have a European export license if we wanted to sell abroad, which we didn't do. And we went through the process of building a plant from scratch, like literally building it from a field. So that was a great learning experience, I have to say. It was, and also because, you know, like all startups, you never have enough money, you never have enough cash. You've got more expenses this month, and then, you know, people aren't paying as fast as they should be paying you, you know, so you're having to manage and juggle. But it was a very enjoyable time in my life. I really enjoyed it. And I think it was definitely a learning curve in terms of also how tough business can be, and how, you know, you start off with a romantic idea of let's have a startup and let's do A, B, C, D, and E. And you can find very quickly that the gloss goes off that, and that you're actually in slog territory. You're scraping around for a few euro to pay the bills. More people are after you for money than are around giving you money. A customer you thought you were going to get won't make the decision until next month, and you were banking on them making it this month. You know, all of those kind of things. And, you know, they are probably no different to bigger businesses. The only difference is the scale. And in fact, smaller businesses are sometimes more difficult, because a bigger business, you've got the ability to be able to get resources. And in a smaller business, you can't afford to get access to those resources.
Throughout your career, you said there, when you got to our dad, they were in a little bit of trouble on the capital side of things.
I wouldn't say trouble wouldn't be quite the right, but it was certainly challenged.
Sure. Is it attractive to you personally to go in and try and turn around a business and to try and improve a business, rather than going into something that's kind of humming along and doing quite well on its own?
I think really for the earlier part of my career, I think that just simply is how it happened. As opposed to, you know, someone said to me, would you like to do this or would you like to do that? And I made a conscious choice that this is what I would do. I responded to the opportunities that were presented to me. And luckily enough for me, and luck has a big part to play in it, in some instances, I was in the right place at the right time and maybe made the right decision. There are plenty of times I was in the right place at the wrong time and probably made some bad decisions. But overall, I think so. It's not something that I decided, oh, I'm good at this. You know, I think probably what anything I did, you know, anybody would probably a decent business acumen and ability to be able to work hard, you'd probably be able to achieve.
Do you think that has stood to you in later businesses that you ran?
Well, so if I go right up to date today, so I have a very different career now, very enjoyable, but in a different way. So I now have invested or co-invested in a number of businesses. the sort of common theme of what I do now is I essentially chair the businesses which I've been involved in, and so I'm involved in a very specialist packaging business. It's probably one of the smallest multinationals. I think we're in 18 countries, quite profitable. It's owned by 3i, and I chair for them, and I have a small percentage that I invested in, and it's great, and I really enjoy it. That's one business, but I'm non-exec chair of that. Another business I'm involved in is a company called Enva, which is a resource recovery business, which essentially we take waste products such as waste oil, for instance, we reprocess it and we sell it. So essentially we take materials that are waste-like and we turn them back into resources, and essentially we get paid to collect and then we get paid when we sell it. That sounds great, but you do have input costs as well, I hasten to add. And that business, though, is very, very much of the now. You know, we've a wood recycling business. We have the only fridge recycling business on the island of Ireland. We have a battery recycling business in the UK. We have a plastics recycling business. And essentially, they all do something. And it's very enjoyable. I'm executive chair of that. So that means that I'm not the CEO. And very important for an executive chair to know that he's not the CEO. But it means that you're more operationally involved than a non-executive chairman. So that's most enjoyable. That's with a terrific private equity company called Exponent, who I really, really like. They're based in London. And then, I'm involved in some personal stuff as well, which keeps me pretty much active. So,
how much of your time is spent looking at new opportunities to invest in versus giving time to the actual businesses that you've already bought and co-invested in?
Well, quite frankly, I started off looking at lots of things, lots of small things, but I realized that that is a shotgun approach, and that is not really a good way to go. So I'm now much, much more focused on a smaller amount of things with a more meaningful thing. So like Enva, for instance. So Enva is, it's a 400 million business. It employs 1,800 people. That's much easier than, I'd say, putting something into, dare I say it, a startup. and the thing as well is, I think it's very important when anybody's going to invest, and if anybody's out looking for money, this is important as well. There are a couple of things investors want to know. One is, if they're going to put their money in, what return are they going to get? And secondly, how they're going to get their money back out again. So a lot of people think, I've got this fantastic idea, it's a private company, I'm going to do it. Would you buy 30% of it? Blah, blah, blah. And some of them, when they're wondering why maybe people aren't, it's because, investors, one, don't like to lose money, and two, they want to have visibility on how they're going to get that money back. I would be very much, I'd use that criteria. And I would also benchmark against what other opportunities you have for that capital. So, if you have a mixed bond portfolio, for instance, that has a yield of 5% or 8% or whatever it is, that's paying you cash 8% each month. So you need to have something that's going to be, maybe if it's illiquid, 20% to be able to compete with that. Mm-hmm. So that's how my mind works. Other people will give you different answers, but that's how my mind works. But I have invested in a broad range of things.
Did you learn that the hard way? You said you started off with slightly, a lot of smaller opportunities. Was there something in that you kind of decided, I'll go back to investing in the larger, more liquid assets?
Well, what happened was I became more ruthless in terms of assessing early and making decisions early of what I would do or what I wouldn't do. Well, probably more what I wouldn't do. And that's actually good for everybody, because then you don't drag anybody along, or, So it's just better to say it's not for you.
Is there an industry specific, it seems to be quite capital intensive, manufacturing type businesses that you'd be involved in? Would that be fair to say?
No, because the Enver business, for instance, isn't a particularly capital intensive business. I mean, it has capital expenditure is part of it, but it's quite low compared to other businesses. And that's because you do a decent amount of reverse logistics, but the actual processing itself is in the various different businesses compared to, say, a glass industry is very light touch. So I wouldn't quite say that. I'm also involved in a company called CMS Distribution, which is an electronics distribution company, which I chair. We distribute Fitbit, GoPro. We essentially fulfill for all non-Apple products through the Apple retail network. We have a big relationship with Amazon. That's a completely non-manufacturing. And in fact, one of the reasons I did that was because it was so different to anything I'd done before, and it sort of fascinated me.
Is there a risk in going into things that you haven't dealt with before, or do you usually have a good confidence that you can understand the business and get to grips with it?
Absolutely. So one of the keys for me, which has been very helpful, is my working with private equity. So private equity has got a lot of resources. So they are very based on being able to do structured due diligence, structured financing. One of the advantages, if you get the opportunity to co-invest, is that there's a start, a middle, and an end. They want a return. They're going to sell the business. So everybody is aligned from day one. And so that answers this question as well, because essentially you're getting access to probably the best advisors and the best help. And there are some very smart guys working in these private equity companies as well. So, you know, getting to work alongside them is also pretty good.
Is there something that you found, you know, throughout your career that you don't actually quite like and you've gravitated towards another style or something else?
Well, I would describe my own style as collaborative, as opposed to autocratic and consensus driven, whilst at the same time acknowledging that decisions need to be made. And so, you know, you can't be like all sitting around the table for days, and at some stage then a decision has to be made. But pretty much though, I would try to make sure that people are on board. And if you don't have people on board, you know, you might have nodding heads around a table, and you know that they are not committed to whatever you're doing, and therefore you're not going to succeed. Quite simple. So I think, you know, you can get brilliant businesses that are very heavily invested in from a capital expenditure point of view, and then have a poor management team and have a really bad outcome. And you can have an underinvested business with a really good team and have a very successful outcome. So to me, it is all about the people and the talent.
Are you involved in hiring and acquiring talent to run the businesses when investing in them?
C-suite.
So the more the kind of CEOs and things like that?
Yeah, CEO, CFO, COO, CCO, sort of more or less that level.
And when you're hiring for, let's say, the CEO position,
yeah,
and it probably depends on the type of business, but what goes into that decision? Is it experience in that particular industry? Is it experience in general? Is it that they've done this particular thing before? What are the kind of key things there when you're looking for a CEO?
Generally speaking, where you can generalize it, you want somebody who's going to be dynamic, somebody who has probably had a modicum of success at a C-suite level before, most likely of a CEO, probably CEO experience, but not, doesn't have to be, but you would normally have a preference. So we would normally put a lot of work into the specification and the profile of who we would want to approach or who we would like to attract to a particular role. Very, very tricky to do a CEO search, and because getting it wrong can be such a costly exercise, both in terms of time, business performance, underperformance, and then also the actual monetary cost of having to switch out a CEO. It can be an extremely expensive process. And if you're the chairman, you're less likely to do it, because often what happens is you get landed with the ball in the interim. So, you know, one wants to tread carefully in these things. But essentially, it's a process which you go through in a pretty much formalized way and try to tailor something for the specific role that you have and the specific business and specific industry. Now, sometimes that might reflect where that organization is in its journey. So, you know, if you want somebody who's going to be growth led, or if it's a business that's sort of like severely challenged and you need somebody who's going to steer it around, sometimes you have somebody who's going to be suited to a particular role for a particular length of time, and then a different skill set is required to take the next step forward. So it's very seldom that one kind of profile is going to cover absolutely everything, because people do have different skill sets and different strengths and different weaknesses.
So what are your plans for the future? Do you set goals in your career? I'm sure now that you're out of the kind of public company environment on the operating side, you're not being looked at the whole time by a board and everything. Do you manage your career by kind of looking to the future and hoping to achieve various things?
you know, the reality of it is everybody wants to be successful. So, I mean, you want to be associated with successes and businesses that are successful, and therefore one wants those businesses to thrive and do well. So, you know, the reality of it is yes, I want to, you know, the things that I'm involved in, particularly the private equity-based ones are, they will be sold. My challenge is going to be, when we do sell those businesses, for me to redeploy that capital. And I don't have visibility of that yet. And I don't feel old enough that I'm not going to do something. So, you know, therein lies. And therefore, I have many contacts with many different private equity companies and a number of bank contacts, etc., just to keep my eye in and see what's happening and, you know, see if there are opportunities, etc. And unfortunately, I've got enough things now. I've had to turn down lots of things. So I'm hoping that we're going to be able to sequence this well, that some new opportunities will arise. So the short answer is I haven't thought beyond the next sort of couple of years.
Niall Wall, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
Absolute pleasure, Connor.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.